This first meeting of the Hamp Special Committee on Fisheries to order. The time is approximately 8:32, and it is January 19th. I'm Representative Gabrielle Ledoux from House District 36. My background is I am a maritime lawyer. To my left is Representative Bill Thomas, the other co-chair. Representative Thomas is from Haines, and he has been a lifelong fisherman in the gillnet and halibut fisheries. He recently entered the southeast spot prawn fishery and has a diverse fisheries background in the industry. He is also a leader of his native corporation. Also present are Representative Harris, Representative Wilson, Representative Elkins, and I understand that Representative Salmon is trying to dig his car out of the snow.
Swimming upstream.
Staff to the committee are Kimberly Wallace of my office and Eon Fisk of Representative Thomas's office. Before we turn over this meeting to the Department of Fish and Game, I'd like to go over a few simple rules for the committee. Number one, requests for hearing a bill should be addressed to the offices of both co-chairs. They must be received no later than 12 p.m. on Tuesday of the week preceding the week during which you wish to hear the bill. Secondly, when coming forth to testify, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Third, please turn off cell phones when in the room. And finally, speak clearly into the microphones when speaking and turn them off when you do not want your comments recorded. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn this meeting over to Doug Meekum, Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries, to come forward and to start the overview. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Doug Meekum. I'm the Director of Commercial Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Good morning to everyone. I handed out, well, before I get into that, I want to introduce Tom Lawson. He's the Director of Admin Services for the department. Kelly Hepler, excuse me, who's the Director of Sport Fisheries for the department. Sarah Gilbertson is our legislative liaison. I guess that's it. I handed out earlier overview of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. It's very general information. I know you have questions. So I wanted to start with our authority in the department. Obviously, Alaska Department of Fish and Game is the primary state fishery management authority, but there are other management authorities. The National Marine Fisheries Service is the primary marine federal fisheries management agency, and everybody knows several years ago the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management assumed subsistence fisheries management on applicable federal waters. The state regulatory regime, the Board of Fisheries, adopts fishery management plans and makes allocation decisions, and the department implements those management plans and those allocation decisions. Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission has the authority to establish moratoria or limited entry systems for state-managed fisheries, and enforcement of fish and game regulations is taken care of by Department of Public Safety, Fish and Wildlife Protection. We also operate in conjunction with a federal regulatory regime established under Magnuson-Stevens Act. It has an exclusive economic zone within 200 miles of U.S. coasts. Decisions, regulations are adopted through the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. The state of Alaska has the commissioner's seat and five other seats on the council. Council makes decisions with respect to Bering Sea crab and Aleutians Island crab and groundfish, Gulf of Alaska groundfish, salmon and scallops. The salmon fisheries in federal waters are managed by the department under delegated authority, as are the Bering Sea, Aleutians Island, and Gulf of Alaska crab fisheries, and also shrimp and some rockfish species. But those are in federal waters under delegated authority. The International Pacific Halibut Commission regulates the halibut fishery. The state doesn't have management authority for halibut in either federal or state waters. And those decisions are made through the council process. And another important Regulatory regime on the federal side is the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and we also have a seat on the Salmon Commission. The next page, the mission of the Division of Commercial Fisheries is shown here. I won't read it. Our division has responsibilities for not only managing the commercial fisheries, but also personal use fisheries around the state. Sportfish also does manage some personal use fisheries. And we also are the primary management authority for subsistence fisheries. And we also conduct, in addition to fishery management programs around the state, research programs. We're responsible for the planning and permitting for fish hatcheries and of mariculture operations. We participate extensively in the Board of Fisheries process. We also participate and have a lot of staff involved in Pacific Salmon Treaty, Alaska-Yukon Treaty negotiations, and as I said, on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Our Division of Commercial Fisheries has about 300 full-time employees, about 520 seasonal employees. We're organized into a headquarters office in Juneau. We have four regional offices. The Southeast region, which is Southeast Alaska and Yakutat. Central region is Cook Inlet, Prince William Sound, and Bristol Bay. The Arctic Yukon region, which is Western Alaska, the interior, and the North Slope. And the Westward region, which covers Kodiak, Bering Sea, and Alaska Peninsula. We're spread out all over the state. We have about 40 area offices. The next map just shows you where those different regions are geographically. I noticed there was a question about the budget. I don't want to, in a short period of time, obviously, I don't want to get into too much of the details. The FY06 governor's request is shown in the left-hand column, and then the 2005 management plan. The general fund increased by about $1.34 million. That consists of a $900,000 increment that we submitted and was approved to do expanded stock assessment, genetics work, and sonar verification in the Copper River, Prince William Sound, in Cook Inlet, and the Kenai River, and in Bristol Bay. And then the another $500,000+ is increased employer costs, PERS. Other than that, it's really a status quo budget. And I just wanted to, biologist, I've got to show some graphs. So, the statewide fisheries graph. I'm just showing here the salmon harvest over time. You can see the bars are the harvest, and then the line is the declining value that we've experienced in the salmon fisheries. Value has gone up a little bit in the last couple of years due to increased abundance of sockeye, a higher valued species, and some improvement in prices. Harvests continue to be very high. Over the past 15 years, we've been at record levels in our salmon fisheries pretty much across the board. The next two graphs show the harvests and value for all species. And what I want to just point out in this is, as you can see, salmon makes up about 15% of the harvest in terms of percentage. You see halibut, shellfish, and herring, very small in terms of the total pounds harvested. Groundfish makes up 82% of the total pounds that are landed in that. We're talking about pollock and yellowfin sole and some of these other high volume and low value species. So they make up the majority of the poundage that's landed. I'm not sure what happened to this next graph. Wow. But what I wanted to show you with this graph was that even though halibut makes up only 1% of the landed catch, it makes up almost 17% of the value. And similarly with the shellfish, even though it's a small percentage, it makes up 13% of the value. So again, that was just a real quick overview, and I'll stop there and try to answer your questions.
Thank you. Do Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Meacham?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Speaker?
I'll ask a couple of questions here. Doug, what do you think are the biggest challenges your department faces this year?
Well, I think one of the challenges that not only faces the department, faces the state, and something that we're involved with is, as I touched on, our salmon fisheries are in kind of a state of distress around the state. And the department is trying to work with, there's a salmon restructuring panel, which is an extension of the Legislative Salmon Task Force. And we're currently working on some options for restructuring fisheries. In the federal fisheries, rationalization, for lack of a better term, is something that's been going on, is going to continue to go on. So I guess working with the various policymakers and the legislature, the Board of Fisheries, and the council process on trying to restructure our fisheries to make them more economically viable, try to eliminate some of the race for fish, safer fishing conditions. So that's one of the big challenges. Other than that, I think it's just kind of the usual. In the Division of Commercial Fisheries, our general fund budget is about, $23 million, somewhere in that ballpark. In real terms, that's less money than we had in 1975, general fund dollars. Now, we've made up a lot of that with federal funds. But even though, our budget has been pretty static, the responsibilities that we've taken on over the past 15 years have increased dramatically. So just dealing kind of with those issues are probably the two biggest things.
I'd like to recognize Representative Kapsner, who's just come into the room, and also Representative Kelly from Fairbanks is here with us. Are there any further questions for Doug Meacham? Representative Thomas.
Thank you. Hey, Doug, we gave you a question sheet that it was in the Tulsiqua Chief Mine. Is fishing game, are they going to weigh in, or have they weighed in regards to the potential impacts to the commercial fishing on this side of the border? For your information, Tulsiqua Mine, for the members here, is the mine looking at being opened up the Taku. It should have a major impact on the gillnet fishery.
Well, Kelly Hepler is the director of sport fisheries, and they have habitat management permitting responsibilities. So if the chair wouldn't mind, maybe he can answer that question.
Doug knew I was going to get up to the mic before he got done anyway. For the record, Madam Chair, I'm Kelly Hepler, Director of Division of Sport Fisheries. Yes, sir, we are, in fact, going to be involved in that. There is a large mining team that's been set up to work with the Canadians on that. And Representative Department of Fish and Game is Roland Holmes, Rocky Holmes. He's Regional Supervisor here, located in Douglas. And Rocky's been around the Southeast probably now for 20-some years. He's very well-versed. So he'll represent the department, make sure our fisheries concerns are being met.
Representative Wilson.
I know the Canadians, when they do open up a mine or something like that, they're really pretty good about getting everybody, all the stakeholders involved right from the get-go, usually the First Nations are right involved, the environmentalists are right there, everybody is right there usually right away. So as they proceed, everybody kind of gets their say. Have we been included in that since we're downstream from there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, we have. In fact, Rocky's going to go to a meeting here in about another month and a half that actually gets all the players to the table so they can have those type of discussions, lay their concerns out.
I'd like to recognize Representative Salmon. I take it you got your car out. Further questions? Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you could discuss the proposed fee increases.
License increases?
License increases, yeah.
Chair again. Good morning, Mary. Yes, the Bart Fishing Game, one of our top priorities is that we're we talked to our legislators. We have some concerns on the walleye side as well as the sport fish side to have some needs for different monies, and I'll speak with the sport fish side, and, you know, I can also speak for the walleye side, or maybe Sarah does. It's up to Sarah how she wants to deal with that. But what we're proposing to do is that right now we have two hatcheries up in Anchorage located in El Madorf Air Force Base and Fort Ridge Air Force Army Base. Those hatcheries are about 30 years old. Their infrastructure has been failing on them. We have some heating concerns. We've been getting some hot water out of the bases to raise some fish, pick a rainbow trout. We're losing those heating sources. Those two hatcheries represent a lot of sport fishing opportunity through the Rail Belt area. And sometimes we've actually even shipped fish down here to Twin Lakes. We've shipped fish down to Kodiak. We went back and we've examined, and those hatcheries right now are producing about 25-30% of the sport fishing opportunity we can do right now because of the hatchery productions is falling. Within the next 2 years, we're going to lose it down maybe 50-60% of the productions come out of those hatcheries is going to go away. And so we're faced with an immediate need to deal with those hatcheries. And so we were successful under Senior Center Stevens to get some money to go out and do an engineering review and ask how do we answer those needs? And the answer we got back is we need to build two new hatcheries. And they suggested building one in Fairbanks and one back in Anchorage, and just essentially raising the ones that we have right now. So then we went back and looked at the money to build those things. It's around $60 million. Now, in addition to that, we also went down to the southeast, and Representative Wilson and I were talking about that this morning, and we asked down here the private nonprofits. We had a meeting in my office a year ago and said, all right, what are the needs facing southeast coming up? What are you, you know, particularly on the sport fishing side, not so much the commercial production, sport fishing side, and tell us what your needs are. So in combination of those two, there's around $63 million need. Now, ideally, I'd like to be able to say we can go get that money out of our bank account or go be successful, get GF. It doesn't happen that way. Or ideally, maybe we can go to Senator Stevens to get the money, but there's a lot of competing needs right now. So we've been successful getting some money back out of Senator Stevens, but there's a gap. And so the only way we could think of to realistically be able to go and build those hatcheries in a time frame that makes sense is to go back out and bond these things out. So we asked, if you need $63 million, what's it take to pay a $20 million bond off? And it comes to $5.3 million. So we said, okay, we want to raise license increases to pay for that then. It's fairly simple. We went back and we looked right now. Our license increase, which represents about 40% of the money we get in our division. 25% of that comes from residents, people on the table here. 75% comes from non-residents. So we structure our license increase the same way. So we're, you know, I view it as kind of the cup of coffee increase in the resident fish side around $5 a year. And I can't find the last time that those things have been raised, and realize my history in the state goes back to about 76. And then non-residents to go up, you know, commensurately the same way in some different fee levels they have. Collectively, those two increases would raise the $5.3 million we need to raise it.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I missed some of that. Could you repeat that again?
Madam Chair, excuse me. Could we have the volume set up? I have a hard time hearing.
I'm sorry. I'll move this
maybe
up closer.
Maybe if you could enunciate a little bit,
okay.
A little more.
All right.
Don't be nervous, Kelly. You're amongst friends.
I'm not nervous. Okay. We'll start over again. Sort of. Mr. Speaker. We have, Mary, what we're trying to do, we have two hatcheries in Anchorage and Fairbanks. I mean, Anchorage right now are producing a lot of fish. And those fish right now are running about 15% of the sport fishing opportunity that we see in the South Central area. About 25% of the sport catch and king salmon come out of these hatcheries. These hatcheries are 30 years old. The infrastructure is failing. Some hot water we need to produce fish in these hatcheries we're losing through the military. And so there's immediate need, we think, to go back and replace these hatcheries. We went back and did some studies. We found out that we need to replace these hatcheries, and we suggested doing one in Fairbanks, one down in Anchorage. And we did some simple mathematics, what's going to take to pay for those hatcheries. And it's around $60 million to build two new hatcheries. It's incredibly expensive to build hatcheries. We searched for different ways, different funding sources we could get to come up with those hatcheries. We've been successful so far getting some money out of Senator Stevens on the federal side. We know we're not going to be successful getting all the money from Senator Stevens. So we went back, and actually Senator Stevens challenged us originally to go back and look at your licenses and see what the state can bring as a partnership into the federal money. That's the time we started thinking about a license increase. We did some simple mathematics again, going back and figure out what would it take to pay off a bond package to build these hatcheries. At that time, you know, we came up, we need around a little over $5 million a year to do that. If
you go back and do some mathematics again as far as how we're paying our license structures now, it raises the resident side around $5, and we have a various different fees on the non-resident side. It raises those commensurately. And so in total, what we're trying to do with that is for the north of Yakutat is build a couple of hatcheries. We also down here in southeast went down and asked what are the needs in southeast, you know, where, you know, if you still want to produce more sport fish opportunity in southeast, where can we do that? And so we worked with a couple of private nonprofits and have some ideas how to do that. You know, there's some work here we can do here out of Skagway, which will actually benefit in a roundabout way here in Juneau, some broodstock interaction, as well as we're going to take care of the Crystal Lake hatchery in southern southeast. So short answer to your question, it's hatchery production, and it's me primarily born in the backs of anglers. Now, is that a little bit clear?
Yeah, that was. You did say it'll be primarily born on the backs of anglers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you said it hasn't been increased since 1976.
It was before that. I went back and tried to find when the last time we raised resident fees. I cannot find that. I cannot even find anybody who was around that remembered when it hasn't been $15. I realize my time in the state's only about 25 years, so I'm not a long-term person yet, but I can't find anybody else that can tell me when it's been raised last.
I guess one of the major concerns I have is for people in the remote parts mm-hmm. of the state who won't be benefiting from hatcheries, they'll be putting money into that for sport fish, and some parts of the state are philosophically opposed to sport fishing. And the name itself is offensive. So I guess especially for areas of the state that are economically depressed, I want to share that concern with you. It's been brought to me by various people around the state.
Through the chair, I mean, we're not raising the low-income license. And so, I mean, that's people economic depressed, I think it's $15,000, I think, Doug, that's what it is. They have a very cheap license, so we're not raising that part of it. We're just these are people buying the normal sport fishing license. The other thing, I mean, here's, you know, we still have programs that we do for stock assessment out in rural areas that benefit rural communities. Now, if, in fact, we cannot get this money through license increases, what we're going to have to do then is go back and figure out some way to restructure how we're presently doing business to pay for these hatcheries. And which means at that point, just pure priorities, we're going to have to go back and look very strongly at some of these, you know, more remote areas and see whether or not we can still afford to keep our area offices open in those areas and also as well as do stock assessment. And the other, the basic need, I mean, this is maybe a selfish look at it, is that, you know, if we keep people fishing in rail boat areas, they're not going to go back in your backyard and go fishing, so.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of a follow-up. I have sit on another committee that is referring to a tax or a fee on cruise ships, and I have kind of heartburn to implement a increase on sport fish on Alaskan residents at the same time we're opposed to cruise ship taxes. How do you, you know, and I think you weren't there, I expressed that to the people that came through the office the other day. How do we get around that? I mean, how do we keep badgering Alaskans and not, you know, get on the people that are coming up here temporarily? I'm not against the hatcheries. I've been a big supporter of hatcheries, but I got hatchery questions coming up too.
Through the chair again, people may view this as a tax. There's no question about that. I think probably some people in Fairbanks maybe view it the same way. We've had these discussions. We can show direct benefit out of this. So it's just not a general tax because you're going to come visit the state of Alaska and this is what it costs us to get in our door. We're going to go back and show you is that if you pay this, we're going to show you what it means as far as being able to take your family fishing. And so that's the linkage. You know, and I don't want to use a hammer. If you don't pay it, this is what it's going to mean on the other side. So I want to keep this positive by saying you show it and we'll be able to do that to you. And we'll be able to show the legislature, you know, we'll be able to come back and show you we're maintaining fishing opportunities by angling these, you know, the amount of money it costs. That'd be the best answer I could probably give on that one.
Mr. Salmon and Representative Salmon, and then I've got a question. Go ahead.
Maybe I kind of missed this part, but the fish going up the Yukon River, I mean, they have a little controversy, I think, around the False Pass area,
mm-hmm.
Area M or whatever they call it. How is that area regulated, and also the entrance of the Yukon River as far as fishing is concerned?
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, the false bass fishery, just like all the other fisheries around the state, is regulated by the Alaska Board of Fisheries. The Board of Fisheries, at the last meeting, increased fishing time considerably in the area and fishery from what it was previously. And a lot of concerns were obviously raised about that as a result, since many of the stocks in the Yukon and the Kuskokwim drainages, particularly the summer run chum and fall chum salmon, have been depressed below historical levels for some years. So, I mean, the short answer is it's regulated under management plans that are adopted by the Board of Fisheries. And the department's responsibility is to implement those management plans and to ensure the conservation of the stocks through our emergency order authority. And this year, under the first year of this new management regime that was established by the board, we were able to pretty much across the board meet our escapement goals. And runs have improved in many areas. Summer runs, chum in particular, improved significantly. Fall chums are still, I guess I would have to continue to classify them as depressed relative to historical levels. And we had, although Chinook salmon aren't really intercepted in the false bass fishery to any appreciable degree, we did have significantly improved runs of Chinook salmon to the Yukon and to the Kuskokwim as well. So under this new management plan, we were able to achieve, you know, getting our subsistence needs met in the various areas pretty much across the board, and the escapement goals pretty much across the board.
I've got a question with respect to Kodiak Tanner crab. Are you expecting the stock to continue increasing?
Madam Chair, I think so in the short term. You know, nobody can really say what's going to happen several years out, but we can look at the recruitment information from the surveys that we conduct to gauge the health of the stock. As you know, the quota was doubled from what it was before. It's a real shot in the arm to the Kodiak economy and to the state and to the commercial fishermen and processors that participate in that fishery. And I think we can expect, again, in the short term, to continue to see some strengthening of that stock.
And kind of as a follow-up on that, on the same line, what type of research has been going on into regime shifts?
Madam Chair,
explain the term regime shift.
Madam Chair, the term regime shift is simply a cold water, cold temperature regime in the ocean versus a warm water, warm temperature regime in the ocean. And through much of the 60s, 70s, we were in a cold water regime. We saw much higher abundances of crab species and shrimp species. Now we're in more of a warm temperature, warmer water ocean regime, and we've seen an increase in the gadded populations, cod and pollock, which also prey on crab larvae and small juvenile crab. So we've seen this shift in the ocean temperature regime that's resulted in a shift in the ecosystem and the predator-prey relationships that exist. And you know, there really is not a lot of research that's being conducted that could give us some insight into being able to predict where we're headed. Really, all we can do is look at what's happened in the past. And that historically hasn't proven to be too accurate. We've also got the complicating factor of global warming and climate change. And we also don't know if the same predator-prey interactions are going to occur if we do go back to a colder water regime in the ocean. So the one place that I can point to that research is being funded is the North Pacific Research Board.
The what?
The North Pacific Research Board. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, that is an endowment fund that was created with settlement funds from the Dinkum Sands oil settlement that Senator Stevens pushed through Congress. They hand out several million dollars a year for research in the North Pacific. And one of the things they're focusing on right now is that very question. looking at physical oceanographic information and other biological indicators. And they're going to have some what they call synthesis research and workshops where the experts in the field can sit down and say, this is the kind of information that you need to collect over the long term to get some insight into those types of questions. As far as what the department does, you know, most of the research that the Division of Commercial Fisheries does is really just directly tied to managing the fisheries. We really don't do any long-term research, particularly into physical oceanography or things like that. But we have been conducting for many years a small mesh trawl survey for shrimp in the Gulf of Alaska. And that is indicating that shrimp populations are continuing to increase, as are some other species of forage fish. So, you know, I think there's some indications right now that maybe, you know, things are turning around a little bit given the improved stock conditions in the Apelio stock, the Bering Sea Apelio fishery. Kodiak area, Tanner crab, some increase in shrimp. So, you know, whether that will continue over the longer term, I really can't say. But there are some changes that are going on.
How long have they been tracking these regime shifts?
Madam Chair, well, you know, there's for a long time in terms of ocean temperature and, you know, looking at things like glaciers, you know, what they call mass balance, that is the melting of the glaciers. So there is some information from those kinds of records that you can look at to give you a kind of a broad scale look at what's happened with ocean temperatures. But tying that back into predictive models for what might happen with, say, managed stocks like cod or crab is where the difficulties are.
Thank you. Further questions? Then I'll ask.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, if we don't mind, thank you, Madam Chair. If we don't mind jumping back to hatcheries, now the hatchery impact, looking at your graph for commercial fish harvest, what's the impact of the hatchery impacts on that catch, and do the cost recovery fish taken by the hatcheries appear on this graph?
Through the chair, Representative Thomas. Yes, the hatchery contributions to the commercial harvest are included in those graphs.
In what percentage they might?
It's upwards of about 20%. Yeah, I mean it's total statewide terms.
Right.
So you know, the major hatchery production is centered in Prince William Sound for pink salmon. The vast majority of the commercial harvest of pinks there is hatchery pinks. And in Southeast, we have a very large chum salmon hatchery program, upwards of, well, I think one year almost 20 million hatchery chum salmon were harvested, but it averages around 10 million chums. So it's a significant contribution. It's been extremely important in Prince William Sound and in Southeast Alaska to the viability of the commercial fisheries.
But does the cost recovery taken by the hatcheries show up on this graph, or is it totally kept out?
Through the chair, Representative Thomas, no, they're considered commercial harvests, just like the common property. You know, the hatcheries sell them, and they're put on fish tickets, so they're included in that. And the percentage of fish that are taken by the hatcheries for cost recovery varies considerably, as you know very well, between the facilities. Some are averaging down closer to, say, you know, 20% of the total production of the total harvest is cost recovery, and some are closer to 60 or 70% are taken for cost recovery.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, and then Representative Salmon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just have a question. You said it was chums mostly in Southeast, and what species was it in Prince William Sound?
This year, Representative Wilson, pink salmon. Yeah.
Representative Salmon?
Yes, I have a kind of simple question. How many hatcheries do they have in Alaska that's kind of full-time, and how many people is employed in these hatcheries?
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, I believe we have about 36 different hatchery facilities around the state. The state of Alaska only operates a couple of hatcheries. Those are the sport fish hatcheries that Director Hepler was mentioning. All of the rest of the hatcheries are, I guess there's one federal hatchery on Baranoff Island, but the rest are nonprofit, private nonprofit hatcheries. So they're run by nonprofit organizations. As far as the number of people employed in those hatcheries, you know, it's a lot, but I don't have those numbers. I'll get those to you, though. There have been some studies also that I could provide you that have looked at the economic impact of the hatchery programs, and it's pretty significant contributor to the economies, and well, particularly in Prince William Sound, southeast Alaska communities like Sitka, Juneau, but also in the Cook Inlet area as well. And Kodiak, not to forget that, Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of the nonprofit hatcheries, how many of them were funded kind of by the state, but they're paying the state back? Or how many have paid it back and they're paid for?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson. Probably be better to direct those kind of questions to the people that loan the money out, but the state built quite a few hatcheries when we had lots and lots of money. We were pouring a lot of concrete and doing a lot of things, and we were building a lot of hatcheries. And all of those facilities, again, with the exception of the two sportfish hatcheries, have been turned over to the nonprofits. So it's you know, some of them were, I wouldn't say gifted, but they were just transferred to the nonprofit organizations. Some were built with loans that are being paid off, and most of the big ones were basically just transferred to the nonprofits. And then the loans that they've gotten are, you know, for their operating expenses and other improvements that they've made, and the hatcheries are paying off those loans.
Okay, so then what was the criteria, what was the reasoning why some of them were turned over and some of them are still having to pay back? What's that criteria? What was the decision? I don't have any idea.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, as I said, when we had a lot of money, we were doing a lot of things with it. But when we started running into some fiscal problems in the state, we made a determination that it'd be cheaper and more efficient for those facilities to be run by these private nonprofits and have their operations essentially self-funded by the commercial fishermen themselves. So it was, the criteria was trying to save money, and we thought we could run the programs perhaps more efficiently that way.
In the short past, I guess, then what you're saying is that some of them, at first we just said, okay, you can just have them and start running them, but then pretty soon we said, well, we need to start paying for them. You need to start paying for them, so some of them are being paid for. The new two ones that we're going to be building, are we talking about having them pay back or not?
Well, through the Chair, the sportfish hatcheries are kind of a different issue, and I'd let Kelly respond to that, but in essence, all of the hatcheries are paying off their loans and paying for their expenses through basically taxes on the commercial fishermen and through cost recovery on the fish that are returning to the hatchery. So it's you know, there are loans, but they're being paid off, so it's really a self-funded program. And I'll let Kelly respond to the other part of that, if that's okay.
Definitely.
The two proposed hatcheries, Representative Wilson, are going to be paid for out of license sales. And so as far as paying them back, I mean, they're being paid back by the, you know, by the user, essentially what Doug was talking about on the commercial side.
Representative Thomas.
Just kind of a quick follow-up on that, if you don't mind. Once you pay the hatcheries off, what do you do with the fees after they're paid off? I mean, you're talking about generating $63 million over time. What are you going to do? Are you going to keep that money and build the department, or... Which would be nice.
Yeah, Director Meekham might have that money transferred into Comfish. constant battle, but through the chair, that's a point of discussion right now. It's you know, I'd love to be able to say we have these bills introduced so we could give you a draft bill to look at, but we're still in negotiations with some legislators about the actual language in those bills. Now, we've been, you know, Senator Seekins, for example, suggested maybe it sunsets. Okay, I think some other legislators are saying in 20 years, don't sunset it, but let's go back and re-examine where we are with our hatchery needs at that time and see, you know, maybe there's need to build a new hatchery, for example, in the southeast. I don't know. And so I think that that's going to be a discussion. Hopefully the bill gets up for this group and other people to talk about that we can discuss, Madam Chair.
I've got a question about the last Board of Fisheries meeting in Anchorage. I understand that there was a proposal concerning fish traps. Does the department have any position on that?
Madam Chair, while the proposal that was in front of the Board of Fisheries for that Kodiak meeting was, it did have a component to it that dealt with fish traps. The main intent of that proposal was more to establish a co-op. What the proponents were trying to do was figure out a way to pool their resources to be more efficient, but also to be able to harvest a better quality product. The set net fisheries in Kodiak are struggling, just like they are, like commercial fisheries all over the state, with low prices brought about by farm salmon. We all know that story. But they can sell their sockeye and other species to some of the more high-end markets, but they've got to have a certain kind of a quality. And it's hard to do that with, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to do that with some types of gear, like set net gear, where you have some bruising, some blemishing that can occur as the fish are caught. They wanted to create some kind of a they decided they didn't want to call it a trap because traps are not legal in the state. But they wanted to see if there was some way they could come up with some kind of a gear that wouldn't be a trap but would still allow them to do live harvest. So they can bleed the fish live and not have the other problems with the quality. But as far as the basic question on fish traps, they're banned by statute. Some people think that it's a constitutional ban. It's not, but it is banned by statute, and the Board of Fisheries couldn't authorize a type of gear or other activity that was banned by the legislature.
Thank you. Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, the hatchery, you talked about replacing two hatcheries that are, is the northern one the Clear facility south of Fairbanks? And the second question is, are you still planning to use hot water from the Usabelli plant, Aurora plant in Fairbanks, or is that not so?
Through the Chair, Representative Kelly, there's the two facilities we're talking about replacing are actually located in Anchorage right now. The Clear facility you're referencing that got shut down in, I think, about 96, 97, and the production got moved down to one of these facilities we're proposing shutting down. And in answer to your concerns on hot water, we're going to have the fund to get the hot water, and we're going to have two sources we're proposing for Fairbanks. One is out of Usabelli, but also we have the same concerns which we just have here, that if Usabelli decides to shut down or whatever happens, we'd be stuck with the same problem we're facing right now in Anchorage. So we're proposing to have boilers. So we're going to have a dual system. We'll have a backup system. So we'll see which was more economical for us to run through time. That way, if Usabelli does decide to move on or something happens, they can't run anymore, then we always have a heating source at a hatchery.
Just so in effect, we've, over time, not geologic quite, but back to 96, we've lost three hatcheries, or we have two that have ended their use life or nearly so, and have lost their heat source. I assume that was Ship Creek when that plant shut down. And then Clear was discontinued because of the loss of load there when they mm-hmm. converted the facility. So we've got three hatcheries in effect that are off of the table. And the other thing is is there some sort of an arrangement that will require, since I understand there's over $1 million required to get the line from Usabelli to the facility, that will require performance by that plant for a period of time that would amortize that line. So, if it shut down tomorrow, that's a bad, the day after the plant opens, that's a bad thing.
Through the Chair, Representative Kelly, we have not done that yet. And I certainly would like to have your support and probably your help to have those type of discussions. I mean, to be completely candid, it's a very, as you know, a sensitive topic in Fairbanks, the hot water of that plant, for a couple different reasons. And so we're trying to meet the needs that we think we're hearing from the community to deal with that, as well as meet our own needs, you know, and its needs of the state to build that hatchery. And I think there's some economic development involved as far as us extending that line, help pay for the extension of that line, to help the city then look for development further on where the hatchery is. That's part of what's going on here. What we've never gone back and said, let's say PC Valley shuts down 4 years from now, are we in fact got $1 million back or not? That'd be an interesting discussion. We just never had those discussions yet. That's a good business discussion to have. And
how could that line be anything other than worthless if the plant shuts down? I don't see how that contributes to future economic development in Fairbanks if it gets shut down.
Well, we've had these same discussions. I agree with that. I you know, they're going to be candid. I mean, left my own devices right now, I would not tie myself to that plant at all. I just run it all boilers and be done with it. But there again, when you're building economic development in a city like that, there's a lot of different things you're hearing. And so, you know, we'll do things which we think are reasonable, that I can look this committee or some other committee in the face and say it makes still makes sense economically to do that. But if not, we'll say no.
Madam Chair, I strongly support using the facility. It has some other benefits, as you say, hardening the river surface in the winter, that sort of thing. But I want to be clear. I support using the Usabelli plant, but I would think that it should be over a period of time that would, at a minimum, amortize the steam line portion of the or hot water in this case of the project. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Overescapement. I know it's not a good word with commercial or sport fishermen, but when I was in Cordova, people's concern up there was the inability to manage or count the fish going up the river. And somehow they're asking you to address that so that they don't have an overescapement. And I guess the argument comes in, upriver users says that there is no such thing as overescapement, but having been a commercial fisherman for several years, there is a time that where they start kicking themselves out, their eggs out. That system alone, we'll just address that one. Are you trying to address that anyhow, any way at all?
Through the Chair, Representative Thomas, well, as you say, one man's overescapement is another's fishing opportunity sometimes.
I realize that. But there is a
But that's not my job to figure that out. That's up to the Board of Fisheries, obviously, to figure that out. In the case of the Copper River, in terms of overescapement, I'm not really aware of any real significant overescapement there. So there are some hatchery stocks that go back to the Gulcana facility. It's a in-stream incubation type facility there that's been pretty successful. Because we, as we get later in the season, we need to protect some of the wild stocks. There have been times when we've had to curtail the commercial fishery, again, to protect the wild stocks, and that's allowed some of these hatchery stocks to go unharvested. And so that has happened in some years. In terms of what we're trying to do about it, I mentioned earlier we put in an increment request to do some sonar verification for the Copper River. We rely extremely heavily on the sonar counter there to count the salmon that are going upstream. We've really never had an independent verification of how well that sonar is working. And so that's an important project for us to try to get a better handle on what the escapement is. And other than that, we try to maximize the harvest as much as we can and still, you know, achieve our escapement goals. And I think maybe I'm biased, but I think we've done a pretty good job in the Copper River over time.
No, I've been involved with you for almost 20 years, and I know you've, you know, been able to meet our needs. One other question. During my campaign, I had to use Alaska Airlines quite extensively. Most of the time, I had to go to Anchorage and take a commuter into the smaller communities because of the out-of-state sport fishing. And sitting in one of the restaurants in Cordova, I almost got sick listening to the table next to me. There was tables of four, and they're bragging about catching and releasing upwards of 80 to 90 coho a day per person, and keeping four or six, whatever it is, and the locals there, and it should be concerned for the people upriver too, is that there's a point where it gets ridiculous. I mean, I'm a sport fisherman, and I know what, you know, when we troll for king salmon, you know, I've been a hand troller before commercial fishing. When you rip the gills and they're bleeding, they're not going to live. And they're talking about throwing them back. I mean, how long is the coho going to live in the river if they don't hold them and release them properly? But I guess it's just a comment that I want to make is how can you get a better handle on the catch and release for the non-residents primarily? I think Alaskans, they go out, get their fish and go home, but these guys are out there laughing about it, and I think it was getting pretty sad there. And then before the day, there was probably 50 people in there talking about up there fishing, so.
Respond that one.
It's a sport fish, yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Thomas, you know, we have done studies on coho research and found out what the hooking mortality is, and it can be significant in these saltwater areas, you know, depending on where they're doing it, over in Cordova, right in the Yak, or do you know where they're doing that. And areas are, you know, we see a lot of that. We've actually gone down and worked with the board and actually restricted catch and release opportunities. We produced a lot of literature telling people, you know, how to correctly release fish, ethics involved. I personally don't subscribe to catch and releasing 80 fish a day. One, I've never been that successful of a fisherman to be able to do that before Doug says it for me. But also, I just, you know, I've had opportunities. I just don't do that. I kept my fish. I eat them. And, you know, it's not that I don't release fish. But that's a personal ethic. Well, we think that ethic then is being violated. The point is going to bother our ability to manage a fishery. Then we work with the board and go back and dealt with that. But it's difficult to say you can't catch and release a fish because, I mean, what's the definition of taking? You know, as soon as it gets on the line, you shake the line, you let it go. But there's things we can do. But we try to work with them. It's on our website. We talk about the proper, you know, handling technique of fish. We've gone places you can't take a fish out of water because of that concern. We've done different things. And so it's not like we're saying we don't care, but it still happens. There's some people out there that don't have good ethics when it comes to catch and release.
Representative Salmon.
Yes. I have a couple questions. Is there any hatcheries in the Yukon River or the Kuskokwim River and I know they probably have some in Canada, but that's probably on the Yukon River, too. So.
To Chair Representative Salmon, there is some hatchery production up in Canada. It's pretty small for Chinook, but it's, you know, it's very small. There used to be a hatchery that the state operated, the Sikasiliak hatchery that was, I guess it was in the I think it was the NOATAC. But that wasn't the Kuskokwim. That was up in Norton Sound area. But there are no hatcheries, Kuskokwim or the Yukon. People have talked about not large-scale hatchery production because I don't think there's a lot of support for that, but what we kind of refer to as rehabilitation-type programs where if a stock is depressed or you'd like to enhance that production to a certain extent using egg incubation boxes, stream incubation type programs, and there's been some discussion of that, but right now there isn't any.
Doug, I've been hearing a little bit about this open oceans aquaculture proposal by NIMS. Has the department done any analysis about that?
Well, we have, Madam Chair, commented in several different forums. I have personally some real problems with what NOAA is trying to do and how they're going about it. The governor, in his comments on the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, made it very clear that more work needed to be done in terms of assessing the impacts and the issues and problems associated with open ocean aquaculture, and called for a 5-year moratorium on that. And one of the things that I've personally pushed in a couple of different forums I've been involved with is if NOAA, NIMS, is going to push forward with aquaculture in the ocean, that these proposals be vetted through the council process, because where these are sited, where these are located, is going to create issues with respect not only to navigation and things like that, but also to commercial fisheries. And so there needs to be a good, strong public process once, if they ultimately do move forward with this, to address those kinds of issues. And so I can get you the comments that we've made on that.
So what's the status of that proposal right now? Where is it?
Madam Chair, it's right now it's still just a proposal. They've done some demonstration projects, one in the Gulf, Louisiana area, and then they're working with a research institution in California using an old oil platform. So there have been some demonstration projects, but there really is no real initiative underway right now. They're still working their way through Congress. I think they're talking about a couple hundred million dollars that they want to be able to push this initiative forward, and they don't have the money yet.
Thank you. Further questions? Are there any other of the department people that were planning on speaking today?
Madam Chair, Director of Subsistence Division, Mary Pete, was originally scheduled to be here today, but there's been a death in her family, and she was unable to attend. So I guess it was just Kelly and I today.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're adjourned.